Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. At this point, the story becomes sadly pertinent to today's movement of peoples fleeing intolerable hardships. In an Austria which by then, following Anschluss, had become the Ostmark, crowds line up in Vienna outside the consulates and embassies in a quest for finding some place to go. It is dangerous to stand in these queues patrolled by the SS, by the local police, or by anyone who might have an old grudge. Police trucks may pick you up and take you to Dachau. People have become shadows of their documents. They wait for papers to be validated, for letters of support from overseas relatives and friends, wait for promises of work in distant countries so as to get a permit to enter those same countries. People who have left or are leaving are begged for favors, for money, for anything that can be of use for obtaining an exit permit. Victor is 78 years old. He trudges from one office to another, rebuffed and barked at, while he stands waiting for one rubber stamp after another. It is only 6 weeks since Anschluss, and with all the new laws and the new men behind desks anxious to be noticed, it is mayhem. Eichmann is starting to make a name for himself. Comfortably set up in the luxury of the Arianized Rothschild Palace, his efficiency impresses his superiors. This office will show that it is possible to go in with your wealth and citizenship and come out only with a permit to leave. A friend in the States has secured young Rudolf a job, so he gets permission to emigrate to the US. Victor and Emmy are left alone in the old house. All servants have left. Only Anna remains, somehow. Victor has nowhere to go. He cannot go to his cafe, to his office, to his club, to his cousins. They are not allowed to sit on a public bench. They cannot ride a bus, cannot go to the opera. The Vienna Oper no longer presents music by Mahler or Mendelssohn. Even the opera has been Arianized. Heedless of the risk, Elizabeth returns to Vienna, her Dutch passport being a precarious shield against arrest as a Jewish intellectual. She is a lawyer and is determined to use her trained mind to help her parents, to negotiate their departure, to get them out of this hell. On the 20th May 1938, the border control give Victor and Emmy their final clearance. It is the same day in which the Nuremberg laws come into force, as they have been for 3 years already in Germany. If three of your grandparents are Jewish, then you are a Jew. You are not allowed to marry a Gentile, have sex with a Gentile, display the flag of the Reich. On the morrow, Victor, Emmy and Elizabeth go out of the oak door and into the ring. They each carry a suitcase and walk to the station where they separate. Victor and Emmy will travel to Kovzcex in Czechoslovakia, and Elizabeth will return to her children in Switzerland. For the last time, they have walked out of the glass-covered courtyard and through the oak door. They have left all behind forever. The train eventually takes Victor and Emmy to Kovzcex on the Czech border. This used to be a good meeting point for friends and family from across Europe. A shooting box, a liberty hall for writers and musicians. But now, the roses are unkempt. And in an old photo which the author shows in his book, the couple look tired and dejected. The house, Emmy's childhood holiday home, the scene of so many happy holidays, is now empty. Borders are unstable. On 30th September, Chamberlain, Mussolini and Daladier try to contain Hitler's aspirations for expansion by the Munich Accord, which sees the splitting of Czechoslovakia. The government in Prague is not present, as the country is dismembered, and the Czech frontier guards leave their posts. There are the first Jewish persecutions. The new border is only 20 kilometers away from Victor and Emmy's house in Kovzcex, too dangerously close. Emmy does not want to be a citizen of the Reich. Even less does she wish to risk being taken to Dachau. Only 4 months after having left her home on the ring, she simply takes too many of her heart pills. Death is her way out, her final solution. Emmy was 59 years old. Victor is now alone, an old man stranded alone in a potentially lethal situation. Again, his daughter Elizabeth will leave no stone unturned to get him out. Pips, Emmy's brother, writes from Switzerland. I am terribly worried for friends and relatives. Sooner or later, all Jewish men are to be sent to the so-called preserve in Poland. He begs friends to intercede for Victor in England. And then the unimaginable occurs. Far away in Paris, on 7th November, a young Jew walks into the German embassy and shoots at a German diplomat, Ernst von Roth. Von Roth dies on the 9th, and Hitler vents all his anger on the Jews under German jurisdiction. He withdraws the police and allows spontaneous demonstrations, and we have the most ominous of nights. Kristallnacht, a night of terror.
The pogrom of Kristallnacht in the second week of November 1938 in Vienna epitomized the brutality of German anti-Jewish repression and Aryanization. Homes and shops belonging to Jews were smashed and plundered. Thousands were stigmatized, arrested, and deported to Dachau. Tens of thousands escaped to the USA. Many more lost their jobs, their possessions, and their dignity. It underlined the beginning of the Holocaust. The state of Austria became a German province, and its former chancellor a provincial governor. Chamberlain's appeasement policy was yielding dividends. France and Italy too acquiesced. The Anschluss made a mockery of international treaties, in spite of verbal condemnations issued by the UK, the USSR, the USA, and other countries. In fact, the Austrians now in Germany became subject to conscriptions, hence resistance was doubly difficult. The Anschluss put pay to the 1926 treaties of Locarno, which had ratified the post-World War I borders. It also destroyed the Stresa Front of 1935, where Italy, France and Britain had pledged to Austria's independence and reaffirmed Locarno. But in 1936, the Rhineland was demilitarized and Britain even signed a naval treaty with Germany. Very stupidly, Britain's Sir Anthony Eden thought that Mussolini's Italy was a greater threat to European peace than Hitler's Germany. Italy's occupation of Abyssinia by 1936, however, was hardly a threat to Europe or to collective security comparable to the Anschluss. Even the brazen diktat of Hitler's expansionist Germany and the reluctance of Western powers to confront him, if not a tendency to appease him, rendered treaties mere pieces of paper. This showed the fear of further violent conflict. But, as time would tell, doing nothing, standing idly by, was not an option. It would only be when Hitler made bold to invade Poland in 1939 that the inevitable became reality. Another world war to stop him.
...680 Jews commit suicide in Vienna. 27 are murdered. Synagogues are burnt across Austria and Germany. Shops are looted, their windows shattered, and their owners rounded up for prison and the camps. Personally, I have met a Viennese shop owner who, on the morrow of that fateful night, was made to sweep away the glass of his shattered shop window barefoot. Elizabeth uses all her resources and writes to the British authorities. On 1st March 1939, Victor receives his visa, stamped, good for a single journey, from the British passport control in Prague. Elizabeth and her boys leave Switzerland, and they all meet their grandfather at Croydon Airport south of London, where Henk, Elizabeth's husband, is waiting to take them to Turnbridge Wells. Victor is wearing the same clothes he had on when Elizabeth left him and Emmy at the railway station in Vienna almost a year before, in May 1938. All he has with him is a suitcase. Hanging on his waistcoat pocket is the key to his beloved library, now scattered and lost forever. Like the many people arriving today in a strange land, a promised land, Victor Efrosi is but an émigré, an immigrant, fleeing his land of poets and thinkers, which has become the land of judges and hangmen. Our author, Edmund de Waal, has a particular ability with using these brief, poignant phrases which touch the heart and so acutely give a clear message. Baron Victor von Efrosi is now Victor Efrosi, an old gentleman, displaced from his home, his library, his cafe life, his bank. He lives with his daughter Elizabeth, her husband Henk, and their sons in Turnbridge Wells, in a rented suburban house called St. David's, an ordinary house in an ordinary Kentish village, 30 miles south of London, safe and rather staid. He sits in a chair by the kitchen range, the only warm place in the house, and reads. He follows the news of the war in the Times. He reads Ovid, particularly Tristia, Ovid's poem of exile.
Ovid, to his book, its nature. Little book, go without me. I don't begrudge it to the city. Alas, that your master's not allowed to go. Go, but without ornament, as is fitting for an exile's sad one, were the clothing of these times. You not be cloaked, dyed with Hyzantine purple, that's no fitting color to go mourning. No vermilion title, no cedar-oiled paper, no wide bosses, horns to your dark brow. Happier books are decorated with these things. You instead should keep my fate in mind. No brittle pumice to polish your two edges, so you are seen ragged with straggling hair. No shame at your blots. He who sees them would know they were caused by my tears. Go, Bob, breathe the dear places with my word. I'll walk among them on what feet I can. If in the crowd there is one who's not forgot me, if there is one, perhaps, who asks how I am, say I am alive, but deny that I am well. That I am even alive is a gift from God. Otherwise, be silent. Let him who wants more read. Beware of saying my choice.
Humanity is surprisingly resilient, and life somehow goes on. Elizabeth learns to cook. She teaches Latin to the neighbor's children for housekeeping money. Her boys, one will be Dawal's father, go to school, where on strict instructions by the headmaster, they are not teased for their foreign accent. She keeps up her correspondence with those of her intellectual friends who are still alive and are scattered around the world, and with her sister Gisela, now in Mexico, with husband Alfredo, after they have got away from Franco's Spain. Other relatives are in Switzerland and in London, but she does not have news of Uncle Jeno and Aunt Eva, last seen in Kovsčeks. Life goes on. It is a pleasant surprise to the family when in February 1944, Iggy turns up in Turnbridge Wells in his American uniform. Like his younger brother Rudolf, he has enlisted in the U.S. Army. Iggy is an intelligence officer with the 7th Corps headquarters. This is where his childhood switching between three languages, English, French, German, comes in handy. He later appears on The Times on the 27th June 1944 in the photo which shows the surrender of a German admiral and a German general in Cherbourg as they listen to the terms dictated by the American Major General J. Lawson Collins. Ironically, victors and vanquished listen intently to Iggy's interpretation of the terms. These are the ironies of life. Victor died in Turnbridge Wells in March 1945, a month before Vienna was liberated, and 2 months before the unconditional surrender of the German High Command. He was 84 years old, and death spared him the pain of receiving the news of the death of relatives and friends in places like the Riesenstadt. The sad news has come in a letter to Elizabeth from Uncle Tibor, who also relates of the death of Aunt Eva and Uncle Jeno. Eva, Jewish, had been taken on to the concentration camp at the Riesenstadt, where she died of typhus. Jeno, a Gentile, was sent to labor camp, where he died of exhaustion. Uncle Tibor also describes the devastation of the beloved Kovsčeks estate, now empty and burnt out. He also tells his niece that he has been to Vienna, to the Palais Effrussi, and reports that a picture of Emmy still hangs on a wall, while some furniture and a few of her father's books are, incredibly, still there. Elizabeth decides to return to Vienna to find out who and what remains, and to rescue the picture of her mother and bring it home. We will be with her in Vienna next week. And so my thanks go to my friends, Professor Henry Frendo, the historian, and George Peresso, the poet.